Platt, who's up here at our oral argument, because the court has a nationally award-winning program called Court with Platt. And students from around the state come to Massachusetts, who come here. These students listen to the oral argument and ordinarily meet with a justice, and we've had lawyers meet with them. So we are delighted to have you and to continue our Court with Platt program. As I have said at each of our sessions, we are celebrating the sesquicentennial of the state. On May 29, 1998, we celebrate the 150th anniversary of Wisconsin's admission to the United States. And so we looked back at the La Crosse County history and found that in the 1850s, there was a judge named Robert Bloomington. And one day, he was hearing a case in which Charles Stevens and Joseph French were the two lawyers. And they were very able lawyers, but they had adopted the rough ways of frontier courts, frontier justice. And as the trial proceeded before Judge Stevens, the lawyers became rather abusive. The story is designed for the lawyers. You all may listen. And the judge warned the lawyers that they should be more civil to each other and to the court. And the attorneys paid no attention to the judge. So the judge put down his pen, took off his coat, and threw both lawyers out of the courthouse. He then went back, put on his coat, picked up his pen, and quietly announced that if need be, he'd whip every lawyer on the frontier to keep order in the court. And so our court monitor for this case is just getting. So lawyers, beware. I will now call the first case, which is 96-2620, Burnt versus Molepsky. The first our attorney will be Mark A. Peterson.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Mark Peterson from the law firm of McNally, Maloney, and Peterson in Milwaukee. I represent the plaintiff appellant in this case, Paige and Caitlin Byrne. In deference to Justice Geske, Mr. Bull and I will try to refrain from any fisticuffs or
other
activity. As a believer in the adage that a good lawyer should at least be able to find a courtroom, I came up yesterday to find this courtroom to watch a little bit of argument, and I also had the opportunity to hear the fifth grade essay contest winners. And I'm kind of glad that I did, because I think the young lady who had the winning essay summed up in one sentence what it took about a half dozen lawyers working on the briefs in this case and all the amicus submissions that this case has generated to say what I think the case in broad principles is about, and that's that children deserve the same protection under the law that adults do. And I think that that's the basic premise. We have challenged the Court of Appeals decision in this case, affirming the trial judge's grant of summary judgment. We think that both lower court decisions are premised on a conclusion that an attorney guardian ad litem in a divorce custody matter who performs in a negligent fashion has absolute quasi-judicial immunity to suit. And I think that the premise of the Court of Appeals decision and the premise of the defense argument in this case is that all guardian ad litems have a duty which is intimately part of the judicial process. That's one of the underpinnings of the argument. And I think the other argument that's made throughout both the Court of Appeals decisions and the defense briefs is that guardian ad litems need some sort of special protection to perform their duties properly.
So what do you see as the duty of the guardian ad litem? And let me just say that this is a case that involves a divorce
Correct.
And custody. So So we're talking about guardians ad litem in that kind of case, right?
Correct. In this case, I think that there's a clear duty that's set forth in a line of cases going back to 1977. We have Demontini and Allen and a number of those decisions. And I think that the guardian ad litem is an advocate.
No,
it's an adversary.
You just set this up. The guardian ad litem is appointed by the court to represent the best interest of the children. Is that correct? Is that all right? Now, who is he responsible as an advocate for the court or for the children or both? Just in your opinion, how is that?
I think that the guardian ad litem functions as any other attorney who presents a case in court. He's an officer of the court. He has obligations to the court within the bounds of ethics. He also has responsibilities to the client as a child. And I think there's a lot of confusion, and we can address it as we proceed in the argument, over this concept of what's the function of a guardian ad litem as opposed to what standard of conduct is he trying to uphold, i.e., what's the best interest of the child. I think that's his goal.
Counsel, have you ever been a guardian ad litem for a child in custody?
Yes, I have.
Okay. So, the child says to you, let's pick someone 10 years old. Maybe 11. You could even go up to 12. The child says to you, you're the guardian ad litem, right? Okay, and you say yes, right? And Pat says, you represent me. What do you say?
I say that I represent you, and I represent your best interest, and my job is to do what's in your best interest. I'm going to do that's the job I can, pursuant to the standard of care, in representing you as an attorney.
Sounds to me that what a lawyer would do, sounds to me like that's what, you're my lawyer. That's what I now think. Well, maybe I'm not. Maybe I'm a little confused. So then I say to you, you know, I've got a secret. I haven't told anyone else, but I want to tell you. And I've seen on television that that I can tell you a secret and you keep the secret. That's what they say on TV, right? So I'm going to tell you my secret. What are you going to say?
Well, I'm going to say that within the bounds of reasonableness, I'm going to try to maintain the privilege, but that you have to understand that I'm representing your best interest also. I wear two hats here.
Now, this is your answer different if I'm in the How do you respond to an adult?
If I'm an adult representing a client, I think the Code of Professional Responsibility has changed a little bit because I think I would have to give a somewhat qualified answer today as opposed to what I would have said probably 10 years ago.
Yeah, but you quote the code, which would say that, you know, if I'm about to murder somebody or have, I've forgotten exactly what it says, but it says if I'm, if you can keep my secrets, I can tell you I'm even guilty of a crime, you won't have to keep my secret if I'm going to tell you all about to commit a crime. And that would be very serious for, I think it's personal injury or, and I don't, I've forgotten if you have property in this, but, so you would say that, but you're not going to say that to the child. You're going to say, I'm going to try and keep it. And I'm going to say, well, look, I want to tell it to somebody who's really going to keep my secret. And you sound to me like you're not going to keep my secret. You might. You might not. What are you going to say to me then?
What I would say to you as the child?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I would say that I'm going to do my level best. I would say that in a perfect world, I wish that there were two attorneys sitting in this proceeding.
Mm-hmm.
One
okay.
is guardian ad litem, and one is adversary counsel. But unfortunately, the way the system is set up here, you're all I got in this case.
Well, counsel, you know, you seem like a nice guy, but this is a very important secret, and I heard the fifth grade essay, too, when I was sitting in court, and I think I want some lawyer who's going to do it. So, what do you suggest I do?
At that point, again, I think we have limitations here. I don't think.
You're going to take me to the court and tell the judge?
I don't know that I can do that either. Frankly, under the Court of Professional Responsibility, in terms of relaying that there's some issue of privilege and happiness, I certainly wouldn't be able to disclose to that court what we're talking about.
I haven't told you anything yet.
I would probably indicate to the court that there is a problem with respect to communication, that perhaps this person would feel better with another attorney involved.
Let me take an example. What if your recommendation is going to be, and I represent the mother, and I understand your recommendation to the court is going to be to give custody to the father, can I take your deposition to find out what you did to come to that decision?
As guardian ad litem?
Yeah.
No.
Why not?
Because I think I'm an attorney, an advocate for a party in the case.
Also a witness offering your opinion to the court on that.
Not under my construct of what the role of a guardian ad litem should be.
Is there anything in the cases or the code that gives an answer to that question?
There is a Court of Appeals decision, I believe, and I'm all of a sudden blanking out on the name of the case, but it was out of Judge Mize's district, and I will come to
it. What did it say?
Yeah, tell us what it says.
It says that, in fact, that issue came up. The issue was whether this lawyer could be deposed or be required to testify at trial in the custody proceeding as guardian ad litem. And the court said no, that because you're an attorney, it analyzed the role of a guardian ad litem and said you can't.
Did he deal with depositions too, or just being called as a witness?
Called as a witness. Didn't specifically address that position. Mr. Peterson, I know that you're opposed to absolute quasi-judicial immunity. Is that correct? What about conditional immunity? Would you be opposed to that? There was a conditional immunity given as far as the guardian ad litem is concerned. Well, I think one possible conditional immunity that makes some sense is with respect to the actual recommendation itself. In other words, that would not be actionable. Whether anyone to the proceeding agrees or disagrees with the recommendation, I think the recommendation should be protected.
In other words, you really look at the functions of the guardian ad litem, is that correct?
My concern is how do you get to the recommendation? If you don't exercise ordinary care, then the problem inherent in this case, and I think inherent in other cases where this issue comes up, is that the recommendation is of less value to the court. And I know that some of the justices here sat on the trial court, and you're struggling with trying to get as much information as you can. And being a trial lawyer, I do believe that the quality of the decision is affected by the quality of the advocacy in the court.
Where would you draw the line? If you were talking about conditional immunity for the GAL, where would you draw the line?
I think everything up to the point of the actual recommendation. In other words, the investigation of the case, preparation of the case for trial, the decision on interviewing and preparing witnesses for trial, obtaining experts, presenting the trial. Those are functions. And again, I think the emphasis is what's the function of a trial lawyer?
So there would not be immunity up to the point of recommendation.
Right.
But there would be immunity for the recommendation itself.
Counsel, in a series of questions you posed, and as I understand it from your brief, you recognize that the guardian ad litem has almost a dual function.
Sure. I think, at least as I have traced the decisions of this court, I think this court has gone in the direction of combining or blurring the distinctions and saying that all those functions are best served when we've got independent adversarial counsel advocating in the case.
And in some cases, the court does appoint two lawyers, one as guardian ad litem and one as the attorney for the child.
That happens in some cases. I think ideally I'd like to see it in every case, but it doesn't happen.
Well, would you advocate that that the lawyer be the lawyer for the child? And that we just eliminate the role of best interest? I don't understand that. But that is the going trend across the country, and several national organizations have advocated that the attorney is put into an untenable conflict by our situation, and that we should be moving towards to avoid this on the council, to make you avoid putting you in the position I put you in. To put you in a position in one that you're accustomed to and for which you're trained, namely counsel.
I can honestly say, in responding to the court, that as a young guardian ad litem 20-some years ago, when somebody told me your job is to protect the best interest of the child, I kind of cocked my head and said, well, what exactly does that mean? I understood or perceived that the job was do your best for that person, that's your client. So it was a simplistic view, but probably one that kept me out of trouble. And quite frankly, I think that would make a lot of sense.
Isn't the guardian ad litem doing the same in the judiciary? He or she is exercising their best judgment, their best discretion, looking at the facts. That is the basic, I would say, argument that could be made that a guardian ad litem, that's what he or she does. They're exercising their discretion based upon the facts as they see them, representing their client and then making the recommendation.
I think every litigant or lawyer, in that courtroom is doing just that for their client. And I would include the guardian ad litem in that.
Do you think that the guardian ad litem also represents the court?
Do I think so? No.
What is the role of the guardian ad litem?
I think the role of the guardian ad litem is to do the best job possible as an advocate and an adversary so that the court has enough information.
Well, isn't the reason that the court appoints the guardian ad litem to be one of them so as to advise the court, get an objective, not advocate, objective determination from an objective party, i.e. the guardian ad litem, as to what represents the best interest of the child?
The guardian ad litem's role is to function independently. I agree with that. And I think that his job, the court obviously is a little bit hamstrung. You can't go out there and question your own witnesses and do your investigation. So I think the fact that you have this guardian ad litem who is supposed to be doing those things assists the court. But I think, and there is a case out of Alaska, which I cited in the brief, the VZVZ case, and I think it's said in a nice sentence, what I think the guardian ad litem should do. It said that the parties in a divorce custody proceeding are best served, and this includes the husband, the wife, and the children, when each of them has separate and independent counsel who are aggressively representing their interests before the court.
Let me continue on for just a moment, which is what the case began. I'm a 12-year-old. You have investigated this. You're the guardian ad litem. The court has determined that you are going to recommend to the court, based upon all kinds of evaluations, and you don't see them at all, that my custody be placed with mom. And I tell you, no, I want you to go in there and argue for the court. I want you to advocate for my position, but I want to go with dad. What do you tell me?
We're now set up under the statute. I think I have to say that based upon the evidence that I've gathered here in the course of my investigation, based upon my expert witnesses, based upon what I think I'm going to present at trial, I'm going to have to go contrary to your opinion. I think it puts the lawyer in a very untenable and uncomfortable situation, but I think that that's what you have to do as things now stand.
Are you going to tell the court? Are you going to tell the court that the trial feels differently?
I think I would also have an obligation to raise that to the judge and perhaps give that child an opportunity to testify about their wishes.
Well, you're not really representing the child, are you? That's the way you would represent an adult. Because if an adult tells you to do something, you either do it or get off the case. Right?
Assuming it's lawful. Right.
Let me ask you about here's the facts, because I just want to see where this might go. It is not uncommon in a custody battle with a guardian ad litem that the parent who loses is unhappy with the guardian ad litem. And that's a common experience. Thinks the guardian ad litem didn't do his or her job, and as a result, that recommendation that wasn't based on proper investigation was made. If we adopt your position, does that give a parent the right the guardian ad litem for negligently doing the investigation, and because the damages are they lost. I understand here we've got a child that for whom damages are being claimed personally. But what about the parents?
Well, let me answer it in a specific and then in a general. In this case, as we constructed it, when I say we, my partner and I. Our view from the outset in this case was that the cause of action belonged to the children, that the parents
don't have the claim.
Why not? Why does the parent have the court is appointed this lawyer. They suffer damages. It's foreseeable that if the guardian line is negligent and makes a recommendation which the court relies that a parent is going to lose his or her custody rights.
Well, and rightly or wrongly, we approach this case from the premise that we represent the children.
And the family. We have to look at the bigger picture and the underlying case
that the guardian ad litem, in the context of that divorce case, exercising his role as we saw it, represented the children.
Well, because my question, I guess, goes to that if it is as narrow as you indicate, which is that the child is the only one who might have the claim, who is the one that can bring that claim on behalf of the child? Is it only the custodial parent, or can the non-custodial parent, on behalf of the child, bring that lawsuit and claim that the child was damaged by being with the other? I'm just trying to see the implications here at this point.
Well, obviously, in this case, custody was joint. The mother was not given primary physical placement.
So in that case, either parent, your position is either parent, believing that the guardian ad litem was negligent in his or her responsibility, could bring a claim, at least on behalf of the child, for
sure. And I do want to say, in deference to my brethren in the bar, I happen to think that lawyers do a fairly good job of screening cases. So I think that when the case comes in the door, people don't instantly file suits. At least I hope not, because of other ethical and legal concerns that go with that. But I think that cases do get screened and looked at from the standpoint of merits. And that was something that was done in this case. And I think that is one of the ways to prevent one of the concerns that I know was raised in the Court of Appeals decision and in the brief, that there's a threat of litigation.
See, one of the problems I'm having with the argument that the guardian of life is only an advocate is that a client suing the lawyer, they're not happy with the result. They had a personal relationship with the lawyer, and they don't like the way the lawyer advocated for their position. Here, it opens it up to somebody being unhappy in the litigation, one of the parents, and bringing a lawsuit because they're not happy with the result, because it wasn't their lawyer, it was that guardian ad litem, it was that third person who offered an opinion they didn't like, and so the question is, and the analysis by the clients, usually are, the GAL didn't do enough work on it. And so it's a different relationship with the parents to bring the lawsuit and have the child think for their own lawyer.
In every case that a lawyer handles, I think there's the threat of suit. Okay, you had this unhappy client, and I think lawyers deal with that. It's part of the business of practicing law.
This is somebody who's offered an opinion that has some impact. I mean, that's what the complaint usually is. In terms of,
well, if one wanted to throw a wrench in the proceedings, then one of the remedies that the Court of Appeals and the trial court acknowledged was still available. Is that someone who's aggrieved can go to BAPR and file a grievance. And I would submit to the court that if, in the pendency of a divorce, one of the parents is unhappy and decides to file that BAPR grievance, there's absolutely no restraint on doing so, at least as I understand the process, and I'm a district chair. I think a BAPR person grievant can go in and file that complaint any time. That puts the guardian ad litem in the same boat as if he were sued. Number one, I think he has to indicate to the court that a grievance has been filed so that the court is aware that this is out on the horizon. Number two, that attorney, as would happen in a lawsuit or any other kind of situation where the client relationship has deteriorated, has to indicate at least, I've got to think about whether the threat of this grievance hanging over my head is somehow or other going to impair my judgment. And I think lawyers, that by and large, are pretty confident in their abilities. Maybe that's a polite way of saying it. And so I think most of them are willing, once they make that analysis, to proceed. I don't think they're that easily intimidated.
Mr. Peterson, my experience, at least when I was on the trial bench, was that most of the guardian ad litems were attorneys who had been in practice maybe 1 to 5 years, sometimes with more experience than that, but frequently lawyers that are young in the practice of law. Do you think that if we do not give absolute immunity, that pool of available guardians ad litem will dry up?
I don't think so, and I'll say it for a couple of reasons. One, I think most young lawyers are practicing in firms. I don't have statistics for that, but I think there is an ethical obligation by lawyers with a little bit more gray hair to supervise and to assist those young lawyers. So I think that's one issue that's or one remedy that's available. Number two, I'm not so sure that the premise that, that young lawyers are going to not do the job or be intimidated is an accurate one. Under the facts of this case, this is a lawyer with about 25 years experience. And I can tell you that when I was a young guardian ad litem, I was appalled by the hallway investigations, I guess is what I would call them for lack of a better term, that were done by guardians ad litem. Where they were meeting their wards for the first time 5 minutes before you walked into the courtroom. And had a quick discussion with them, quick discussion with the family, and bingo, and out of court with a recommendation as to the best interest of the child. And those lawyers tended to be older lawyers who one would see as being very seasoned, and I think they just didn't take it seriously.
Well, you're probably aware of the fact that this court has now issued rules in regard to educational training for guardians of life. Avoid just the kind of situation you described.
I think that's a great step. I can also say that as a trial lawyer, I firmly believe in the strength of the tort system. And with my partner who's sitting here today, his grandmother always used to say, if you don't listen, you have to feel. And I think that from the standpoint of tort law, that one of the purposes of tort law is to make sure that people exercise ordinary care. And I think that that would be a good complement to the education process of guardian ad litem for public health.
What other states have our kind of dual system of being both an advocate, really for the child and for the best interest of the child? And what do they do, you know? And who divides it up the way you would suggest?
It's pretty limited at this point, I have to say. And the cases out there are all over the map in terms of context. Some of them, we cited pretty much at length the Collins versus Tabbitt case out of New Mexico. That was a personal injury case. Beasy was an Alaska case which is similar, at least involved custody, and I think the court made some pretty definitive statements about the role of the guardian ad litem there.
You're mentioning your law firm or a law firm giving help to the brand new lawyer at GAL. It reminded me of a case we had argued here a month or two ago about negligent hiring and negligent training. Suddenly they accept as your senior partner to be sued also because they haven't broken GAL.
Well, the Code of Professional Responsibility says that lawyers have to supervise. And I can say that at least looking at it on the grievance end, we're starting to see more of those kinds of grievances getting filed, too.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. You have 5 minutes.
Mr. Bowles. Thank you, Justice. May it please the Court. My name is Charles Bowles, B-O-H-L. Out of Milwaukee. I represent the defendant respondents, National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh, and Ms. Siglia. Let me begin by saying that I agree with Mr. Peterson in one respect, that children deserve the same protection of the law as adults. Where I believe we disagree is how to achieve that end. It's my argument to you this morning that that end is best achieved by giving guardian ad litems the kind of protection they need to do their job without the constant fear of retaliation and retribution. Before I begin my argument, Your Honors, I would like to make one very brief and straightforward observation about the record before the court. There was no discovery in the circuit court. There were no depositions. Expert witnesses were not disclosed. In the record before Your Honors, from the divorce proceeding, it's really quite selective. There is not an entire transcript for you, and I make this observation only to underline the fact that there is no basis to conclude or even suggest that Mr. Masaglia was negligent in the custody proceeding, and that issue, of course, is not before you.
No, but does the court have to assume that even if you were very negligent, whatever that means, that you would say there's immunity?
Absolutely. And I believe that is the assumption the court has to make. The observation I would simply like to make is that the record at this point is completely inadequate to support their conclusion. The issue before the court is, of course, an issue of first impression. The cases from this court that have addressed the issue, at least tangentially, the Tyson v. Tyson and Willa Yeager, are really not particularly helpful. both cases are dated. They predate modern statutes. They certainly predate Section 767. And the holdings of those cases, while they're dicta, the cases also don't deal with custody disputes. They deal with will disputes. But while this court has never addressed this issue directly, the majority of courts, as noted by the Court of Appeals, have come down for the rule that I'm advocating for the court today. A majority of the courts that have considered this question have held that guardians ad litem in divorce custody proceedings should be entitled to quasi-judicial immunity.
As a matter of curiosity, what does the term guardian ad litem literally mean? Do you know? Have you looked it up?
The Latin? No, Your Honor, I'm afraid I haven't.
Okay, I'll find my flag.
The meaning of the term is defined in 767, but what the Latin means, I just cannot give the court much guidance on that.
I didn't understand about it.
Let me ask you, if I might, whether or not conditional immunity would be appropriate, as was suggested by Mr. Peterson. What would be wrong with this court granting conditional immunity and looking at a functional approach to the work of the guardian ad litem?
Well, I think there are two questions there. I think a functional approach is appropriate. I don't think that leads you to conditional immunity for the simple reason that regardless of how you structure the condition, there will be some backdoor way in which a disappointed litigant, a frustrated parent, is going to be able to find a way to, in fact, sue the guardian ad litem. Using the suggestion of the petitioner in this case, which I might add I don't believe is supported by any court in any case, the suggestion being that the guardian has immunity for the recommendation, but not for the investigation or the presentation of evidence to trial. If that is the rule, I think all disappointed litigants are going to determine that the real flaw in the representation by the guardian ad litem had to do with the investigation. There's a certain amount of irony in the petitioner in this case taking that position, because it does appear from the circuit court decision in the divorce case as though the circuit judge rejected the guardian's recommendation. So that a short answer to your question is, regardless of how you set the condition, you are going to be leaving a door open to allow a frustrated litigant to sue.
Why should we protect the guardian ad litem when the other attorneys involved in the process could be sued for malpractice? What is the reason why we should protect the guardian ad litem?
Well, Your Honor, I think there are probably four reasons. The first reason is that if you don't do that, you are going to kill effective advocacy by the guardian ad litem. The guardian ad litem is different than any of the other lawyers in one important respect. The guardian ad litem is protecting the societal goal of the best interest of the child, as opposed to the wishes or desires of a particular litigant. If the mother's lawyer or the father's lawyer refuses to accept the goals or objectives of the mother or the father, that lawyer should seek to be substituted by someone who will accept those goals. On the other hand, there is no litigant in the courtroom. There is no party in the courtroom to give direction to the guardian ad litem. And it may well be that a guardian ad litem doing an exquisite job will look around the courtroom and see that everyone except hopefully the circuit court judge will be a little unhappy with the job that he or she is doing. That is different than being an advocate in the case. That's the first reason. I believe the second reason is that if you don't give guardian ad litem this form of immunity, you will, in effect, be giving litigants the ability to completely disrupt custody proceedings. If you allow the guardian ad litem to be sued in negligence, it seems to me there is no logical technique or reason why the guardian ad litem can't be sued, for example, during the very divorce case. At that point, there is an obvious conflict of interest. Most guardians are going to want to withdraw, whether they do or not, and you will have allowed the litigants in an extremely emotionally charged situation to disrupt the proceedings. The third reason, Your Honor, is closely related to the second. The third reason is if you allow these suits in negligence, you will, in effect, be allowing the disappointed parent to transfer the venue of the custody dispute from the circuit court hearing the divorce case, where they got the result they didn't want, and transfer that dispute down the hallway to another circuit court in a negligence action.
Suppose the guardian ad litem is now going to become the representative of the child.
The advocate.
The advocate. And the child tells the secret, the child tells what parent the child wants to go with, and so that's what the lawyer advocates. And the court listens to that lawyer. This is all the lawyers, but except in toto, the child's lawyer's recommendation.
The wishes of the child.
Right. To which maybe the lawyer agrees. Might not, but this time he does. So, now, whichever parent lost custody is very angry. And can't get angry at the child, because, after all, you want to retain relations with the child. So they're angry at the lawyer for malpractice, didn't carefully investigate, etc. Can the parent sue? Well, maybe the child now changes his mind and says, hey, look, I'm only 11. Why are you listening to me? What do I know? I'm only 11, and I'm all mixed up with this, and you should have done a better job investigating this for me. And you investigated it, you would have blah, blah. Even I didn't know those facts. You should have found out.
Your Honor, first of all, I think that is a very predictable and probably very common fact, then. If the advocate, the guardian ad litem, now turned advocate, does what the 9 or 10 or 11-year-old wants, there is very real risk that the child, at least if children in general or anything like my children, are going to change their mind.
Well, my point and my question is, it doesn't matter if it's an advocate or if for the child or representing the best interest, the parents are going to sue. You think that's going to... Lawyer always has that risk, and that's what your opposing counsel said. So a lawyer always has the risk that they're going to be sued for malpractice, for negligently handling the case. So what difference does it make if you sue this way or sue the other way?
Well, I think one of the difference is this. If I accept my client's goals and wishes, which I'm ethically required to do, so long as they're legal and not in violation of the Code of Professional Responsibilities, and I advocate to the best of my ability, I have an excellent chance that my client is not going to be unreasonably unhappy with me, even if I lose. If, on the other hand, there is no client to give me direction, there is no client to tell me a goal or a direction, and that's something I have to pick on my own, there is an excellent chance.
But the law gives you standards that you have to apply, whether you're the court's lawyer, the child's lawyer, or representing the job. Standards of due care, right?
Due care in the protection of the best interest of the child. Now, the best interest of the child may be completely different in the best wishes of the child.
I know, but don't you have to still do the same investigation? I mean, whoever you represent at the bottom end,
the due care standard, the jury instruction we would give the jury in a negligence action would be the same. And we would hope that the guardian ad litem, regardless of immunity, lives up to the same standard. I believe that's the most complete answer I can give to your question.
Does the judge have a different role overseeing the guardian ad litem as opposed to a lawyer for a parent?
Absolutely. The judge has a different role in a number of respects. First of all, the judge selects the guardian ad litem. In the real world, I think it's fair to conclude that guardian ad litem who make themselves available for these kinds of appointments and who do a good job are going to be selected over guardian ad litem who are available but who don't do a good job. So the judge selects the guardian ad litem. The judge has the ability to discharge the guardian ad litem at any point for cause. The judge is responsible for the guardian ad litem's rate of compensation, and ultimately the judge has one other power over the guardian ad litem, which is not direct, but I think it's important, and we see that in the facts of this case. The judge has the ability to simply reject the opinion.
I'd like you to explore that with us a little bit in terms of whether or not there's a difference when between a lawyer advocating for a position and a guardian ad litem making a recommendation to the court. What it is that the court will do in terms of talking to the lawyer, asking the lawyer questions, exploring things with an advocate versus a guardian. I mean, I have a sense that the role would be different in those two parties, but I'd like you to explore that with us. There is a difference between the way a judge would treat a guardian ad litem's recommendation versus the mother's or the father's lawyer's argument that custody ought to go to one or the other.
The recommendation of the guardian ad litem, Your Honor, I believe should be seen by the circuit court in the light that the guardian ad litem is protecting the societal interest of the best interest of the child. The best interest of the child may be radically different in the wishes of the child or the desires of either of the parents. Because the goal, the mission of the guardian ad litem is different, the circuit court should appropriately view the recommendation differently.
Let me ask you that. Can I ask the case that Mr. Peterson cited from Judge Mines? I saw that, remember, I did not read it in preparation for the argument. But can a judge question a guardian ad litem as to the investigation that he or she has done, what they've done? And is that something that a judge would do with an advocate for a party?
Well, Your Honor, I was afraid you were going to ask that question because, like Mr. Peterson, I can't recall the name of the case, but I can recall reading the case, and I believe that case stands for the straightforward proposition that the guardian ad litem can't be called as a witness and can't be cross-examined. That is not to say the circuit court can't interrogate the guardian ad litem as to their recommendation, just as Your Honors are interrogating me this morning.
We're asking you questions.
Politely. I meant
by
that.
Most civil.
It's just your perspective versus ours.
Counsel, a few minutes back you were asked why, to give us reasons to hold as you did. You said there were four, but you only got to number three. What was the fourth?
Your Honor, I had a professor in law school who did that constantly, frustrating all the note-takers in the classroom. So let me get to the fourth reason. The fourth reason, Your Honor, is the reason that I think is discussed in the amicus briefs of the family law section of the State Bar and the amicus brief of the Legal Aid Society, and that is following up on the suggestion of Justice Crux that the pool of qualified lawyers who are willing to accept these cases is unquestionably going to be smaller if you allow them to be sued in negligence. It is an empirical question as to how much smaller that pool is going to be. I have no doubt that there will always be lawyers who will be willing to take these assignments. I believe, following up on Justice Crook's observation, there is a danger that the lawyers will be particularly junior and particularly inexperienced. It is, I think, unchallengeable that the pool of experienced lawyers, the lawyers we want to draw from to protect this extraordinarily important societal interest, is going to be smaller. Your Honor, I am not a matrimonial lawyer. I have not been a guardian ad litem as Mr. Peterson, but in reviewing the amicus brief in the family law section, I must say I was surprised at the rate of remuneration that guardian ad litems receive now. being...
Were you surprised because it was high or low?
I was not surprised because it was high. In urban areas of the state, Your Honors, I respectfully suggest that that is not quite enough to cover the ordinary overhead of a law firm. In these days of substantial legal malpractice deductibles, the real-world reality is the guardian ad litem is taking on perhaps an unreasonable financial risk to take this assignment at those rates with the fear that they will be the target, perhaps the likely target.
Well, here's what bothers me. If you've got lawyers who are contracting with the law and to represent children in these laws, and they are getting paid small amounts per hour, which I gather you're saying, which the family law section says, then they can do one of two things. They can handle very few cases, which is not permitted under their contract, usually with what is called contracting. So in order to do the number of cases, some of them will decrease the amount of time that it might be necessary to spend on a case.
No
that's
doubt.
That's one way of handling, no doubt. So now we've got lawyers who are not spending adequate time on the case because they're not being adequately compensated, and they've got to support their family too, right? And now you want to give them immunity. That just compounds it. So what we're doing is not paying them enough. And the court, you know, I wrote the opinion, I think, to the court that said we could do this. But we're not paying them enough. They're cutting the time, which means they're going to cut two services. And now you want to give them immunity. It seems to me you have to go the other way of saying, hey, you're not immune. So don't contract unless you're willing to put in the time and do it pro bono, as you say, for the public good. You're just protecting them and wasting on the child who's the consumer and the court itself. Because what if I told you, and I don't know this, but that 85% of the time the judges accept the guardian ad litem. I don't know that, but I bet it's high.
I believe it is high. I believe it's certainly higher than 50%. And that's, I don't know that either, but that's simply...
I just filled the number out.
It is, I believe, an empirical question for which none of us have the necessary data.
War stories.
Excuse me?
War stories.
Sure it is. The countervailing argument is if the quality of the pool of people who are willing to accept these appointments is sufficiently eroded, it may not make an awful lot of difference as to the degree of diligence with which they do their job. Protecting the societal interest, the best interest of the child, is a tremendously difficult and important job. One would hope the person who is advocating for this position has some experience in life from which to draw and some experience in the courtroom as to how to present their position. Those are the kinds of people we want in the pool.
And we're very fortunate across the state of Wisconsin to have just those kinds of people, regardless of the amount of money that's paid per hour. So I don't intend by my question to indicate otherwise. It's just that we look at the pool.
It might make sense that if a person is underpaid for the work he or she is doing, the very least society can give them immunity for what they're called upon to do. It's sort of a quid pro quo thing. We put in for a lot more money to guy in than they spend on the counties every time by their signing separate contracts to fresh people out of law school to do work. So I see a balance of other that if we need the guy in light on, we have the oath of being a lawyer, we assume they follow the oath, that they're going to be the best work possible, even though they are underpaid. But if you assume that, or if that is the norm, then they should at least not have to be sued every time somebody thinks they didn't do enough. Well, that's a statement on the question.
You're
a ballot.
Yeah,
right.
I agree.
Good. And a couple weeks ago, sir, didn't know how to say it. Yes.
Put him down as a
deputy. Well, I was trying to count it.
If I've answered your questions, let me conclude by simply saying I'm asking this court to adopt the majority position. There are just a couple of cases that I would like to note in passing because I believe they are significant. At the time the Court of Appeals wrote its decision, it could note only one contra case. Now, the case was the Fleming versus Agbill case out of the Fourth Circuit. The Fourth Circuit was considering South Carolina law. Unbeknownst to the Court of Appeals, a matter of days before it issued its decision, the South Carolina Supreme Court had overruled the Fourth Circuit and, in fact, said, no, that's not what South Carolina law is at all. I would also note a recent decision from the Seventh Circuit, the Schweid versus Grant case. In that particular case, the Seventh Circuit was citing a case under Illinois law, but it's significant because in Illinois, this is an issue of first impression. The Seventh Circuit reached the rule of law that I am advocating to the court this morning, and I think there is very little question that the Seventh Circuit found quasi-judicial immunity for guardian ad litem to be the better rule of law. Your Honors, let me just end by saying that giving guardian ad litem in the 767 divorce custody dispute context quasi-judicial immunity is consistent with a number of past decisions of this court. It's consistent with giving clerks of court and assistant district attorneys immunity, as you did in the Ford case. It's consistent with giving witnesses and judges immunity as you did in the Dowd case. It's consistent with giving court-appointed medical experts immunity, as you did in the Bromond case. And it's consistent with giving court-appointed experts in custody cases immunity, as you did in the Snow case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bowl. Peterson?
Thank you, Your Honor. In responding to a couple of points that Mr. Bowl made, I have a real concern. I heard terms like fear, chilling effect, disruption of proceedings. I didn't hear anything about what I think is the root cause of why we're here today, and that's the expectation that lawyers are to exercise reasonable care in doing their jobs. And if they do, I think a lot of these concerns go by the wayside. I don't have the statistics on a number of legal malpractice suits. I can say that we're here on a case of first impression today, so I don't think this case has come up before the court before, by definition. And I don't think, if I had a nickel for every time I've used or heard the floodgate argument in court, I could have retired a couple of years ago. And that's what I think I'm hearing here. And I'm concerned because as an attorney, I don't think that a group of lawyers needs immunity to do their jobs, which I think is the basic premise of our position with the court.
So you disagree basically that any good public policy that immunity is assessed. In other words, you're saying that you don't think that the fear of litigation or the potential for it to show is at all.
I don't believe so. I have no empirical evidence, nor does the other side offer any empirical evidence on the floodgate. I can tell you that if remuneration is the problem, and I certainly agree, I think guardians ad litem are undercompensated, but I can also tell you that I think plaintiff's lawyers are often undercompensated because you do cases on a contingent fee. And you take the risks, you do the job, and sometimes you get paid and sometimes you don't. And so I don't think that that's the engine that should drive this train either. I'm concerned that the public is going to perceive that this is lawyers protecting lawyers in this kind of situation. And
if all of you choose, you'd have to regard the judges.
Well,
judges protecting the judges.
Well, I think the judge sits in a different seat in this situation and is making the decision. So I'm endorsing judicial immunity. But I think that lawyers should be held accountable. if they don't do the job. And maybe the point I can conclude on here, I'm getting short time. Just two things I want to bring out. One is we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that lawyers have insurance coverage for all this. One of the defendants in this case is an insurance company, and I can indicate to the court that the policy in that case...
Not all lawyers have insurance.
Not all lawyers.
There are lots of young lawyers that are out there without insurance, right?
They're supposed to have it, but they don't.
Well, there's no requirement, is there?
Well, let's put it this way. Prudence would...
they have the money.
but the E&O coverage in this case covers...
You've got to be ready to light them in order to get the money.
You got to get some fees, that's true. But I think that any claims arising out of the acts, errors, and omissions that one commits in rendering professional services is what's covered under this policy. And I kind of chuckled, I said, because in effect the insurance company uses a functional definition of what a lawyer does in deciding whether to give coverage. And clearly, guardian ad litem work is within the scope of what lawyers do every day as part of the profession. I think the last point I want to make, and this is the one that probably concerns me more than anything else, there's a real irony here. The defense is asking this court to grant immunity to protect the strongest and most capable people in the system of divorce and custody attorneys. The whole concept of guardian ad litem was designed to protect those who are most disadvantaged and the weakest in the system, the children. And if we take this to its logical extension, we're going to give immunity and protect the people who are most capable. And it's going to come at the expense of those who are the weakest. And as happened in this case, and counsel was right, this case was decided early on summary judgment, so we have a lot of what we did was based on the record in divorce and the record in the subsequent criminal conviction of the molester here. But the concern I have is that the injury to those children goes unaddressed because of that question of immunity and the approach that they use. Thank you all.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. The court is in recess until everybody is seated for the next case.
The court thanks the lawyers for coming from Washington State tonight. Okay. Or over here.
Not yours.